Hold on one second, Gru. I got Peter Cetera on the phone. Yes, Mr. Cetera? We need legal counsel? Yeah, Gru, we may have to ask your dad to come out of retirement.
I already got him on speed dial. Like, two seconds into that song, I knew we were in deep shit.
Well, it is a train wreck, if you will. But it's a good one. Gru, We Are Nothing Worthwhile, America's number one bi-coastal podcast featuring two annoying Jews. Mm-hmm. That's important to remember. It's two annoying Jews. The name of the show, folks, is indeed Nothing Worthwhile. I'm taking a look at the iconic studios in Coral Springs, Florida. The iconic mug of flat diet soda.
Not flat. This is brand new, man.
Oh, brand new?
Bought it yesterday.
I am viewing via Zoom, if you will. My partner in crime on the East Coast, Mr. Glory Hole of Love himself. I want to get to more important things, Andrew.
What would that be, Evan?
I don't know if it's more important. It's more important to me, but I want to scale back to our last podcast. It was indeed the sequel to the iconic Karate Kid film. It was The Karate Kid Part 2. Gru, we discussed in following in regard to Karate Kid Part 2, we discussed the background into the second film. It's principal photography and shooting in Oahu, not Okinawa. Bill Conti and the music of The Karate Kid Part 2.
Yay!
Gru, what we loved and what we did not love about the plot of Karate Kid Part 2 and the commercial and critical reaction to the film. Let me see here, Gru. My notes say that I would say for the most part our reactions were quite similar to the film, despite the ridiculously plot, the over-the-top dialogue and production, those damn drums and sheets of ice. There was something very enjoyable about the return to the Karate Kid universe. While the iconic first film was Daniel's story, here was Mr. Miyagi and Pat Morita's chance to take the lead here. Gru, until late last night, the viewer email was mostly quiet. I don't know if you have the jingle jangle ready to go.
Oh, we do.
Until a certain hardcore fan blew up our inbox late Friday night. Andrew, you ready to rock and roll? Can you get to it?
Letters.
It's time for viewer mail! All right, Andrew, thank you. Courtesy of our Facebook fan page. I don't even have it in front of me, but it's Facebook, Nothing Worthwhile, 1985, I believe. We're going to thank our hardcore fans. Let's just put it out there. Stephen Gruthius, a lot of comments. I will throw it to Andrew and myself for response. Almost drove off the road at the end when Andrew Gruthius slandered Ghostbusters 2. I love that movie so much. Shameful. Let me just throw it, and then I'll throw it to you. I don't even remember you slandering Ghostbusters 2. I mean, maybe you didn't like it, or you didn't like it as much as the original, which I think is very fair. Andrew, any thoughts on your brother's comments about Ghostbusters 2?
I don't remember saying anything about Ghostbusters 2. The only thing these two movies have in common, Ghostbusters 2 came out the same year, the same summer as Karate Kid 3, but that, I don't know what I said. Look, Ghostbusters 2 is a lot of fun. We love it as fans. Maybe I said it's not really a very well-made movie, which it's not. Maybe that's what I said, but still fun to watch because it's Ghostbusters and it's the same people and whatever. I don't know what else I would have said. I'll have to get some clarification on that. But I don't apologize. I do not apologize.
Let me ask you a question on the production side. Yeah. Is my mic equally up? I felt like last episode I was a little low, like when I was trying, like you couldn't hear. I'm just curious.
It's hard for me to tell because,
don't worry about it.
No, I always make it sound.
No, it doesn't, I don't want you to stop. Don't worry about it. I was just curious.
I can call Scott the engineer here and we, you know.
Yeah, he might
son of a bitch!
He might be available. There's like literally threads of Reddit conspiracy theories about Scott the engineer out there. We'll tackle that on the Scott the Engineer podcast.
Yeah.
But it would be a fun topic. Gru, regarding Police Academy, if you love Mauser, you should speak for yourself. I hate Mauser.
What?
I loathe him. nothing to like about him. I don't even, did you say anything about Mauser?
When were we talking about Police Academy?
Well, I think you did mention something in regards to Police Academy as comparative somehow to Karate Kid. Now, I made the comment that I thought it was a cheap riff of Stripes, which I believe you agreed. And then I know you're clearly more of a fan of Police Academy. I mean, I think it's basically a fun, silly knockoff series of movies. The first one was of decent ilk, and then the rest were kind of levels of sham filmography afterwards. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember you mentioning anything about Mauser, but I don't know. I thought I'd put it out there.
But if one wants my thoughts on Mauser, I think...
Yes, I want your thoughts. Tell the Nothing Worthwhile Universe your thoughts on Mauser.
If you're comparing Mauser to, like, Harris, because that was the basic role, Mauser took Harris's place in Police Academy 2 and 3. Mauser was a lovable... He wasn't the kind of villain that Harris was. Harris was an evil villain who you loved to hate. Mauser was more of just a clown that you don't take very seriously. And to me, he was a little bit funnier that way. He was he was such a putz that, and the actor, Art Matrano, is so funny at it. The guy who plays Harris is hilarious too, but in a completely different way. I don't prefer one over the other. Why would I slander? Oh, he said we're supposed to hate Mauser. Well, I didn't hate him. I loved having him on screen. Because he was always funny.
Cool. You mentioned the actor that was Art Matrano that played
Matrano. With a T.
Yeah. What else was he in?
He was in
TV.
He was like a bit player on TV shows. He'd pop in as a familiar face on as like a guest actor for dozens of shows. Movie wise, he was in a movie called Teachers.
Yes. I remember that movie.
He was more of a stand-up comedian. He was on The Tonight Show a lot. He was like an old-school stand-up comedian. Then he had like a massive accident, like he fell off a ladder and was like paralyzed, but he still acted and he still performed and he's still alive. He's still out there. But I can't remember much else besides just seeing him. He's like a that guy. He'll like show up in something and you didn't even weren't even expecting him. He's a talented guy though.
All right, thank you on your thoughts on Mauser. Steven goes on to say, I started watching Karate Kid 2 last night. It is on demand on AMC. Movie starts with a warning that stereotypes are not consistent with views of today.
What?
I got a lot of thoughts on this. I'll throw it to Andrew first. Ugh. Your thoughts on your brother watching it, and they got to start Karate Kid off with a warning.
What's happening to us?
I don't know what's happening. And I'm just so... Look, I'm not getting on my soapbox. I'm just going to say this. There's just so much about... today culturally
is it because
so much that art, whether good nor bad, and I'm talking even about wrestling art, that's for the viewer to interpret, and I don't need a warning to tell me that we know that stereotypes are bad. It's just a PC run amok, but that's the kind of times we live in.
I don't even know what they would be what because there's a Japanese guy in it. There are Japanese people in it, and they're not actually in Japan. Because why? Because the people who are playing a lot of these Japanese people don't really have Japanese accents. But we wouldn't know that. How would we know that?
Here's what I think. Hey, Evan, what do you think? I'll tell you what I think, Andrew. I'll tell you what I think, what I really, really think. I've said this before, Karate Kid would not be made today simply because of it. I'm going to say it. Sorry. It's the wise Asian sage helping a white kid, a white male. And I just don't, I think, you know, in this move of diversity, that's not to say you won't see that again, but it's, these were like tentpole movies, you know, helping the white suburban kid. I just don't think you're going to see that or see that very often. I will talk about Karate Kid 3 because it does amp up a little bit of the language and whatnot. And I'll save that for when we get to Karate Kid 3. But I mean, do we really need a warning before Karate Kid 2 to let us?
No.
I mean, the viewer can't judge for themselves, and parents can't parent anymore. It's really ridiculous. It's really ridiculous.
It is 100% ridiculous. I don't even know what they're referring to. Japanese people still have accents. I mean, in 3 there's more derogatory terms. But I'm sure there's a warning thing on 3 if AMC is what he was saying. But yeah, I know that they did that thing with Gone with the Wind, with other, like, they're putting these stamps on American history as if they want us to look at these things through a lens saying that this is not who we are or ever were, and that's dangerous. Like, it might not be who we are anymore, but we definitely were, and we can't ignore where we come from. And like, I really don't like it when they do that to things that we've been watching for decades and has caused not one race riot. Or not, like, when was the last time there was a big rap Karate Kid rally where they were, protesting the portrayal of Japanese Americans? I mean, I just don't get it. I think people don't think much of other people anymore. You know?
I was with you. I'm with you. The whole riot thing, I'm not getting into that, but I agree with you.
That's a joke, obviously, but I'm just trying to figure out what they're trying to accomplish.
Well, do you think, what are they trying to accomplish? I agree with you.
I agree.
Shockingly enough, I agree with your take. I think, even, look, I don't want to get it, but you're trying to erase and quote unquote whitewash, so to speak, our past. And I agree with you. We don't need, people can parent and people can judge historical pieces of art and culture and movies on their own without having a network,
do it for you.
Especially a cable network that really doesn't have to, adhere to standards.
What are the rating systems for? They're supposed to come on and say this movie has been rated PG. Parental guidance is suggested. What else do you need? Put that up there. You've been doing that forever. What's wrong with that?
Well, speaking of perhaps stereotypes, the next comment is please. His name is Sato. Not the way that both of you are pronouncing it.
How did we pronounce it?
I don't know. Sato? Was that completely wrong? I don't know.
I've been pronouncing it Sato. Yeah, he's saying that it's supposed to be like Otto, like Sato. Maybe. In retrospect, that's the way they are saying it in the movie, but I think it's open to,
all right, listen.
Phonetically.
It's
like the difference between bonsai and banzai.
Tomato, tomato. All right, let's move on. I counted at least 3 Rocky references. Enough already. I never even think of Rocky. I mean, come on. When I see the opening credits of Avildsen and Conti's name, I don't know. It's our podcast. It's my opinions. And I'll tell you that in Karate Kid 3, I will bring up later today a comparison to a Rocky movie that I caught, and I think it's a valid point. I mean, you're talking about Avildsen, you're talking about Conti. Is it so unfair to bring up a Rocky reference? I don't
Not
know.
Not at all. Not at all. Especially since the themes are the same. Many of the themes are the same. Underdog, you know, fighting against the odds. I mean, it's the same kind of thing.
When I was a young kid, I didn't think Rocky, but I'm older now and I'm more a savvy moviegoer. I'm, you know, and so these things pop in my mind and I'm trying to just get good conversation with Andy and that's what I thought.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, that's part of the whole thing. We are going to compare not just Rocky, but we are going to compare these things to other movies that are that we think are similar. Hell, I don't even remember how it happened, but apparently we were talking about Police Academy last week. I don't know why did that have to do with anything. So
that would be good for you to go, we need to go back and listen and figure out how we went to Police Academy.
Yeah, I don't even know how that entered the conversation, but that's, you know, when we see similar tropes, I know you hate it when I use that word, but you know, when we see similar things like that, we're gonna talk about it. What's wrong with it?
I think we brought up Police Academy because we used to go have a drink at the Blue Oyster. Oh, wait. Is this mic on? Anyway, Steven goes on to say that you did not mention that the drums that everyone was using to get Daniel back at the fight became very popular. We had at least one in our house. And what resonated me the most about the drums was Andrew's comment that at the ending fight scene, it does get a bit ridiculous that everybody in the crowd has those drums and they're spinning those drums, where Gru said, I would have bought into it a little bit more if it was just maybe Miyagi and the girlfriend. But no, it's like he passed out a drum set to everyone.
They were like bar mitzvah party favors.
Right, and I was like, you know what? Gru is right. It is kind of ridiculous. Any thoughts on the whole drum thing?
I stick with what I said. I'm not – Steven – I think he's saying that, you know, I was making fun of it. Yeah, it was a little over the top ridiculous, but that doesn't mean that the drum thing shouldn't be in the movie. It's one of the things that it's basically what the technique that he uses to beat the guy is based on. I don't remember one. I'm trying to remember if we had one. I mean, if Steven says we did, we probably did. I'm trying to remember. I'm drawing a blank on that one, but. Come on, Steven. You're nitpicking on that.
Come on, Steven. You're better than that. Steven, go.
Yeah.
All right. Let's finish up on Steven's comments. Must you include sci-fi references, Aliens 3, Predator, massive eye roll? I'll take this one and then I'll throw it to you, Andy. The only reason why we mentioned that, or I mentioned it originally, was Aliens 3 completely X's out Ripley and Newt in the beginning of the movie. And my whole point was Karate Kid 2 X's out Allie and Mrs. LaRusso within, you know, the first 3 minutes of the movie. That's it. It was a curious choice. We both thought it was curious. I think we're both okay with it, but it was a curious move for them to go that route in Kid 2. And I thought Andy's points in the podcast were well received when I listened to it again about how he thought it could have been enriched by some early scenes with Allie or the mother to make the full Karate Kid 2 story a little bit more complete.
Yes, agreed. And I think Steven's just talking about, you know, those sci-fi things. It's got nothing to do with sci-fi. They are sequels. And when we're talking about a sequel, we're going to compare it to other sequels. Just like we compared this to, you know, we compared it to Rocky. We compared it to, you know, evidently Police Academy as well. So, I don't think it's a sci-fi thing. It just so happens that Evan's a huge Alien fan. I'm a huge, and we're both huge Terminator fans. So obviously we're going to call back the movies that we're familiar with and that we like the most, when there's a talking point. So, you know.
Right. But it wasn't per se sci-fi. It was just that Alien 3 canceled out two of the major characters. Now let me ask you a question about Kid 2, because I didn't really research this. I mean, was there a lot of controversy when they decided to go this route with nothing with Ali and nothing with, cause we didn't talk about that.
Not that I recall.
I mean, they just kind of veered ahead with Daniel and Mr. Miyagi and out the way goes Mom and Ali.
Not that I recall.
Okay. Okay.
I don't remember even giving it a thought. I think, well, it wouldn't have made sense for them to be part of the story because neither of them would have gone to Okinawa with them.
No, so, but your point was, hey, show a quick scene with Daniel at the prom fighting with Ali, or show even a scene where he sits down with the mother and the mother says, look, I got to go to Fresno. And then he was like, Ma, even if you don't show Ali, Ma, I just broke up with Ali. Now it would have added a little bit more fullness to the story.
Yes. And we're getting ahead of ourselves with this one, but I'm just going to say one thing. They do fill in some of these gaps in Cobra Kai. And we'll get to that in a couple weeks.
Yes. Okay. Well, I want to focus on the current stories at hand, but yes, they do. Absolutely do. Yeah. I think I said in the, this guy is the balls. What does that mean? I have no clue. I don't know who I was referring to. Maybe it was the kid bad guy, but basically this, you know, the guy is the balls, meaning he's super cool and super bad and just a big tough guy. Let's skip down. Love the Black Rain reference. Every time I think of the movie, I remember where I saw it. Camp Wayne, Rainy Day. We were in the canteen, and I believe I was actually in that canteen.
Yeah, me Steven, too.
Watching that movie from 200 feet away on a small TV. All I remember is that Andy Garcia got killed and the Asians were the bad guys. That's all.
Did they put a disclaimer on that one too?
No, that was back in the day when Asians were cool bad guys. How dare they?
How did we? Oh, I remember you. Oh my God! Stereotypical.
I thought the actor who played Sato was in Black Rain.
Why? Just because it's an Asian?
No, come on. Stop. Well,
no, you're right. Yeah, that's how we brought it up, and no, it wasn't. I don't even know the guy's name who was in Black Rain. Besides Michael.
Andy, your brother asks, what is the term breaking of the fourth wall? What does that mean? I have no clue. I'll throw it to you because you could probably say it better than me.
I know what it means. I just don't remember when we talked about it. Breaking the fourth wall.
Breaking the fourth wall is
when you're watching a movie and they talk to the audience. For example, John Landis, the director, loves to do that. If you remember in some of his movies, a character will hear something really stupid and just turn and look directly at the audience. Like, what an idiot. Breaking the fourth wall, like, in Johnny Dangerously, when Johnny Dangerously starts talking to the audience and says, hey kids, don't smoke, you know, like, that kind of thing. I don't know where that would have come into play last week. I'll have to.
Well, perhaps here, I'll give you where perhaps it comes into because Steven goes on to say, I didn't think the scene in Better Off Dead was making fun of Asians then. I'm getting a little reverb in the headphones. Okay, that's better.
You sound fine.
I didn't think the scene in Better Off Dead was making fun of Asians then. I don't think it is now. I just think it's funny. Lethal Weapon 4, that was making Asians look bad. Now, let me just respond to the first part, and I'll let you speak about Lethal Weapon 4 and the whole deal. I didn't say that they were making fun of Asians, but to have an Asian guy doing a Howard Cosell impersonation, I felt like it added to the comedy. I mean, to do a Howard Cosell impersonation is probably tough and unique enough. But to have a young Asian guy do it and do it well, I'm sorry. I just think it added to the comedic element. And I don't think I'm wrong, and I don't think that's a weird thing to say. But, I mean, I don't think it's making fun of Asians. I think it's adding to the comedic element.
I'll stick by that comment. I agree 1,000%. The way that guy did it, I don't think it was his voice, but it was no, I don't. I'm pretty sure it was dubbed.
You're probably right.
I'm pretty sure it was dubbed, but his facial expressions were absolutely priceless. He was great. Like, and it's fun to think about because he's so funny in that little part, yet he's such a bastard in Karate Kid 2. It's fun to see some of these actors, like, you know, stretch like that. But where did Break the Fourth Wall come in?
I don't know, but let me ask you, was there something said about Lethal Weapon 4, or is there something about Lethal Weapon 4 and Asian stereotypes?
I think he's referring to is the fact that the bad guys in Lethal Weapon 4 were an Asian, I guess, trafficking ring. I don't remember. It was Jet Li. He was, you know, the main bad guy.
That was like at the beginning of his career, right? Jet Li.
He was an action star in Japan for a while before that.
Right, but wasn't that his first big role in the States?
It might have been, yeah.
It is.
I don't remember anything other than that except the Expendables, but I guess that's what Steven's talking about, how, you know, it just happens to be a group of Asians who are the bad guys in this movie, that doesn't make it about Asians being bad guys. Like, what's going on?
Well, Gru, Steven goes on to mention that you've mentioned Jerry Goldsmith and you do not mention Hoosiers. What are they teaching in this place? Andrew,
I maintain.
I think you mentioned Hoosiers. Go ahead.
I thought I did. I remember actually it being in my head, and I think I was mentioning it just as you were moving on to another topic, so it might have gotten lost in our overlap. But I remember. Why am I explaining this?
Yeah, by the way, like, doesn't he understand we're just conversing? And I sound like Howard now.
Yeah.
Stuff comes into our head, and we. All right. Anyway, here's a good final point. Steven goes on to say, "So wrong on Apollo. You're supposed to hate Apollo.
Oh.
I absolutely hated Apollo. There is a smidget of something for him when Apollo acknowledges that he gave it all." As he had against Rocky in the hospital part two. Other than that, you do not start to feel anything for Apollo until Rocky III. Totally disagree. Now, may I take a first crack at it and I will toss it to you.
Please.
I believe on the podcast, no, I know what I said. I rooted for Rocky to win. I didn't hate Apollo. I respected him. He was a little arrogant. If you remember, you know, he's trying to pick a tomato can to set up a fight. But other than that, the guy mostly had pretty admirable qualities. He trained hard. He was a family man and he gave it his all and he fought Rocky honorably. So I hated Johnny until the end when there is a redemptive moment in Karate Kid. Now we'll talk about Cobra Kai and all that other stuff later on. But as a young kid, I hated Johnny. I hated him. He was a bad dude. We may disagree on the levels of badness, but I didn't. Yeah, Apollo, I wanted Rocky to win because he's the good, you know, he's the hero, so to speak. I didn't hate Apollo. I hated Johnny. That was my take on it. Andy, what's your comment on your brother's thoughts?
Here's the difference, and it's very simple. When you, in the first Rocky, you want Rocky to win, but you mostly want Rocky to go the distance because it's Rocky's story. Apollo is just. Or Apollo is hardly even part of it. And he's a great caricature of Muhammad Ali, and he does a terrific job. So he's likable. He's not the villain. He's the guy standing in the way of where Rocky wants to get to, but he's not the villain. But here's what I'm going to say. You don't root for Rocky to beat the shit out of Apollo. You root for him to win. In Rocky III, you want Rocky to beat the shit out of Clubber Lang because you hate Clubber Lang.
Yes, okay.
You hate Clubber Lang, but you never feel those kinds of feelings against Apollo. You'd rather see a great fight between the two, not just an ass kicking.
And I don't mean to take you off topic, but I did hate Clubber Lang, but I respected him because I liked the way how they portrayed him. He's from the streets. I love those early scenes where he's grinding it out. There's not a lot to – in terms of his personality, yes, I hated him. But I hate to say this on Clubber Lang, but I had a level of respect for him because he was grinding when Rocky got kind of rich and
he does do some bad things. Apollo didn't do bad things. He didn't, you know, he would mug for the cameras. He would sell the fight. He would promote the fight by being antagonistic. Clubber was being antagonistic because out of pure rage and hatred. So, you know, they're very different. But we're getting way off topic here, but that's
this will be one of these classic podcasts.
You never think of Apollo Creed as a villain. I've never thought that. Never. In fact, in the second one, he's more of an asshole because now he's taking the fight seriously in Rocky II. He becomes kind of more of a dick, but you still respect him because that's when you see him with his family and you see what he's going through. He's being called, you know, over the hill. He's being called a fake, you know, so you sympathize a little bit with that. So you don't hate Apollo.
Andy, while I'm setting up for the next segment, why don't you give us some final thoughts on Karate Kid 2?
Karate Kid 2 is one of those great times that you sort of slap yourself for having because you know it's not healthy for you, but it still goes down so easily. Great, great performances, a very over-the-top plot, which is so much fun. Everybody gives it their all. You got a nice tie-in song that you can butcher like we did. It deserves the respect that it gets, and it does get a lot of respect amongst Karate Kid fans. And I think that's grown over the years. I don't think it was as respected when it first came out, but it's more respected now. I've always enjoyed it. I enjoy it for what it is. I know it's not a well-made movie, but I can still love it, and I do.
But anyway, Gru, Karate Kid was released in 1989, Part 3, excuse me. The Karate Kid Part 3, again, is an American martial arts drama film. It is a sequel to The Karate Kid Part 2. The film stars Ralph Macchio, Pat Morita, Robin Lively, and Thomas Ian Griffith in his film debut. As was the case in the first two films in the series, it was directed by John G. Avildsen and written by Robert Mark Kamen, with music composed by Bill Conti. What was the cast for The Karate Kid Part 3, you say? Again, we mentioned Macchio, Pat Morita, Robin Lively as Jessica Andrews, Thomas Ian Griffith as Terry Silver, Martin Cove as John Kreese, Sean Kanan as Mike Barnes, and of course, Randy Heller back in a cameo as Lucille LaRusso. Let's get to production. After Robin Lively was cast as Jessica Andrews in The Karate Kid 3 in 1988, producers were forced to modify her role of protagonist Daniel LaRusso's new love interest because Lively was only 17 at the time of the filming.
And Macchio was like 35.
Ralph Macchio was 27, although his character, Daniel, is 18. This situation caused romantic scenes between Jessica and Daniel to be rewritten so that the pair only developed a close friendship. I got a lot of thoughts about this right off the bat.
So do I.
I was going to talk about it, and maybe we'll talk about it again with the plot, but Robin Lively, Jessica Andrews, give us some thoughts, Gru.
Well, Robin Lively actually was kind of she almost was an it girl of the time. She would pop up in these things. I could name she was in a movie called Teen Witch, which was supposed to be a big hit that ended up being a major bomb. She would pop up on like, sitcoms every now and then. Very pretty. Very, 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 very pretty girl. But for this, what you just described, because in the movie, she's dead weight.
Just say it.
She's dead weight. She's got nothing to do with literally anything. She is literally there for Daniel to give the audience some exposition to. and she balances out the male-female ratio, but she's literally got nothing to do with the plot. And if you're gonna, if they're rewriting the role around the actress, and the actress is not the star of the movie, then you gotta get a new act, because she's 17, then you gotta get a new actress.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta get somebody else, because otherwise you are wasting time. You know, their relationship is nothing. It's empty. They don't have to be lovers, but there's no reason for her to be in the movie. And, like, that's just one of many mistakes this movie makes. Then it's not her fault at all. She does well with what she's given. She's just given absolutely nothing.
So I agree with absolutely everything you said. No fault of her own. And again, the choice in terms of a beautiful girl.
Yeah.
Just like the first two female protagonists, she's beautiful.
Yeah.
She's beautiful. She's convincing, but I just don't get it. A love interest with no love of friends. I mean, I'm watching this movie going, and I'm sorry to call it out. I never saw a guy do so much for a girl and their friends. It just didn't make sense to me. You're probably maybe a little more softer about it, but I hate to say it, stupid. I, you know, a young guy like that.
There is a scene. There's actually a scene that they take the time to write and film in this movie to explain why they're not going to hook up. Remember that part?
She's like, well,
I'm just letting you know when they're going on their
Columbus,
first. Yeah.
A boyfriend in Columbus, Ohio? I mean, come on.
And she's moving, and she just moved in and opened up this pottery shop, and now she's moving back in a month? Like, well, like, it's so lazy. It's like, you need this particular actress that bad that, you know, you're gonna, you know, get somebody else. There are plenty of people out there they could have gotten. And again, it's got nothing to do with her and her abilities. It's just that if you're all of a sudden Hollywood has scruples, then, you know, what they did was just create some dead space and fill it in.
Yeah.
It's like filler on an
album. I
agree
with you. I agree with you. That's a good take on that one. Let me get to some other takes on casting. John Kreese was initially intended to have a larger role in the film, but due to Martin Cove's filming schedule, conflicts with the movie Hard Time on Planet Earth, the character of Terry Silver was written into the script. Grew, thoughts on John Kreese's limited appearances in this film?
Well, I'm surprised to hear you say that, because he's a major part of it. He's in it way more than you know, the girl we were just talking about. He's one of the main.
Is he really?
I would say he's got a good, you know, 20-25 minutes of screen time. That's when you're not the.
He comes in at the beginning, which is okay. It's effective. He then goes on a vacation. I got a lot of thoughts about this.
Okay.
I want to save it.
No,
for
I'm not saying it's good or bad.
Vacation,
I'm saying,
and then he comes back for a final. Again, I'm surprised, because my thing to you, I agree with you. If you're writing roles and changing them due to age, commitments to other films, and either you got to hold production and wait till everyone's ready to go if you're going to really make the best movie possible, or
yes,
you write that character out and you go a completely different way. I want to save the actual plot with Kreese when we get to it, but
okay.
if you know, like you said, I mean, if you're writing around somebody's age, it just doesn't make good sense.
I don't know. Kreese is a little different because he's already part of that universe. So it's like you're gonna work harder to accommodate that character than you would a brand new character that nobody's gonna care about anyway. There's a big difference. But it's serendipitous because they did if you know, and I read that too, that they created the character of Terry Silver around that. And in the fan universe of The Karate Kid, Terry Silver is a huge favorite. People do love this guy as a villain. And even though, you know, I think Thomas Ian Griffith is great in the movie. He's really the only good thing about it because he's so much fun to watch.
Oh, well, let's just end the podcast. Good night, everybody.
What? I'm just saying that what you described is, you know, it's sort of good that Martin Cove was not that available, so they had to write this part, and I wouldn't say it saves the movie.
All right.
But it gives it something that it desperately needed.
But understand our podcast.
What?
Let me explain to you our production.
Oh. Go ahead.
I want you to touch upon this, but I save those real hardcore final takes for when we wrap it up. Right?
Oh.
Thank you.
Okay.
But I don't disagree with any of your things. I mean, let me ask you a question. What does a movie do? What is a movie, let's go with Mission Impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Mission Impossible 51 comes out and they want Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is already committed to another role. What do they do? Do they offer him more money to buck off on a prior commitment, or do they wait for production until this guy is free? I mean, that Martin Cove character, the John Kreese is a key character. We'll talk about the effectiveness in the plot, but let's say they want Martin Cove as in a starring or a fairly big co-starring role. He's now filming Hard Time at Planet Earth. Productions are similar times. What do films typically do?
Well, it depends. In this case, I'm betting.
I don't want to hear about that, but I mean, you're a film guy. What would a film do?
For this one?
They want Tom Cruise, but he's got a prior commitment. How do they work around that?
With that, you wait. Because you're talking about one of the biggest movie stars who ever lived. So you wait for it.
Martin Cove was a pretty big character in the Karate Kid universe.
But here's they should have waited, but here's what I'm betting this was the case. They wanted this movie to be out for the summer of 1989. That was the summer of the sequel. That was Ghostbusters 2, Indiana Jones 3. There were a bunch of other ones. Batman was coming out. They wanted, I think it was a Star Trek V, you know, they wanted to throw their hat in the ring and be a part of this big wave of huge tentpole movies. So if Pat Morita was too busy, then they'd have to wait. But you're talking about a secondary character. Now, do I wish they would have waited? Yes, because then they could have fixed the girl problem too. But some movies, they have to get out by a certain time. Others can afford to wait. It also doesn't hurt that Cruise, I know you're going to slap me for this, but Cruise, I believe, is one of the producers of the Mission Impossible franchise. So he kind of has a say in what happens with that.
Yes, you get a virtual slap.
Yeah, but what you're saying, if your main guy is not available, then you have no choice but to wait. But Kreese or Jessica, they were not the main guys, and I guess the studio decided, you know what? Fix the problem. We got to get the movie out by the summer. I will bet that that's what happened with that.
Well, I'm going to take Andrew's comments and just roll with it. Robin Lively was Jessica Andrews. I was going to formally just talk about her, but Andrew kind of put some stuff out there about her. But let me just, Robin Lively was a child actress. She's appeared in several television shows, including Silver Spoons.
Second Chance.
Silver Spoons. So you and together, we're going to find our way. Silver Spoons together.
You and together.
We're going to find our way. Punky Brewster.
There was a Starman television show, which
that couldn't have been much. That couldn't have been very good, though.
But I actually watched it because I love the movie Starman, and the TV show was a continuation of it. He comes back in a different body, played by Robert Airplane Hayes. The woman, Jenny Hayden, who was played by Karen Allen in the movie, is played by Erin Gray of, wouldn't you know it, Silver Spoons fame.
Ooh.
And Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood. But, That's about it. That's about it for her. Yeah, but Robin Lively actually had a part in a TV show that Stephen will love that I'm bringing this up. A show called Second Chance, which lasted on Fox about 7 or 8 episodes, and she was in one of them.
Was Friday the 13th Part 7 A New Blood, was that the one where he goes up against like a Carrie, like a girl with telekinesis?
I think so. That was
the
New Blood.
That's the best one. I love that one. I love it.
Ah.
Let's see. Lively Grew also appeared in feature films Wildcats, which literally has the greatest nude scene.
Yeah, she was
the
daughter. She was her daughter. I remember that. Yeah, well, look at that.
That Goldie Hawn in the tub scene.
Yes, gorgeous.
Still grinds my loins. something like that. I don't know if I need to do a disclaimer.
She was the daughter, but Robin Lively was the daughter who got drunk at the party. Right.
Okay, well, I just want to focus in on Goldie Hawn's gratuitous. Nude, completely gratuitous. Does not push the plot forward one iota, and I loved it. Teen Witch, not quite human. Let's see here. She won at 19 an Emmy Award for her performance as an insecure teen in the 1991 ABC After School special, Less Than a Perfect Daughter.
They give Emmys for those?
In the 1990s, she had recurring roles on Twin Peaks, Doogie Howser, M.D., Chicago Hope. In 1996, she appeared as Lane McKenzie, one of the three lead characters in the short-lived WB drama.
Savannah. I knew it!
In 2003, Lively played NCIS Special Agent Vivian Blackladder in the JAG episodes Ice Queen and Meltdown.
JAG?
In 2008, Lively appeared alongside Holly Hunter in an episode of Saving Grace. She was in a role in the TV show Cold Case. And 2010, she appeared in the Twin Peaks-inspired Dual Spires episode of Psych, which I did watch once or twice on the USA Network. Let's see here. She's married to fellow actor Bart Johnson. And Bart. Well, Gru did mention Robin Lively. He also mentioned Thomas Ian Griffith as Terry Silver. Griffith was born March 18th, 1962, American actor, producer, writer, and martial artist who has starred in many films and television. He was born in Hartford, Connecticut. His first feature film was indeed 1989's The Karate Kid Part 3, in which he played Terry Silver, a rival martial artist who influences Daniel LaRusso against his friend and mentor, Mr. Miyagi. Let's see here, Gru. I'll give you a couple of things. Starred in the film Hollow Point. I do remember that movie with Tia Carrera.
I remember it.
He appeared in the 1998 John Carpenter film Vampires.
Which you and I saw together in the movies.
As the head vampire Jan Valak. In the 2002 film Triple X, in which he portrayed agent Jim McGrath. His first television role, Gru, was on the soap opera Another World as Caitlin Ewing, from whom he played from 1984 to 1987.
Caitlin?
In 1999, he started the TV
movie. Back up. Caitlin?
Yeah.
Caitlin.
Catlin. That's what I have.
Mm.
You're not talking about the other Caitlin.
I don't know. I'll have to check out Another World.
By the way, I will say the 2017s or so, Caitlin Jenner phony phone calls on Howard are pretty funny.
They are very funny.
Probably the last time Howard was edgy. starred in the TV movie The Secret of Giving with Reba McEntire in 1999. He also starred as Rock Hudson. In the 1990 TV movie Rock Hudson.
Oh, my God.
About Hudson's life, for which he received critical acclaim. He's made guest appearances on a number of television shows, including In the Heat of the Night, Wise Guy, and One Tree Hill. And Gru, he has periodically wrote and worked as a story editor for the NBC television series Grimm, which I've read about. I know absolutely nothing about, but I know that was a new television series based on the Brothers Grimm fairy tale. I don't know if it's still on or blah, blah, blah. So, Grew, are you familiar at all with Thomas Ian Griffith, like Beyond the Kid franchise?
A tiny little bit more than you, but not much. 90% of those things. 90% of those things I've never heard of. But he was the bad guy in the Vampires movie that we saw. I remember us liking it. The John Carpenter movie. They were trying to, after Karate Kid 3, he was like, he got the only positive, like, notices for Karate Kid 3. So after that, I remember they were trying to make him into, like, the next Steven Seagal, and he ended up being, like, the next Jeff Speakman. But I remember there was one movie that I remember seeing coming attractions for in the movie theaters. It was called Excessive Force. Sounds like right out of the Steven Seagal playbook.
I feel like I've seen that or seen the trailer.
I've never seen the movie, but I saw the trailer. He plays like a cop who's going after like a mob guy who was played by Burt Young. I never actually saw the movie. I don't even think it ever. It's one of those movies that was supposed to come out, and it was, I guess, supposed to be so bad that it never actually came out into the theater and went directly to video. It was one of those, and other than that, I don't remember much else that Thomas Ian Griffith has done, but his work in Karate Kid 3 is top-notch stuff. It really is.
Oh, my God.
I'm telling you.
I don't know
it
about
is.
Top-notch stuff.
I believe it is. I think to be able to steal a tentpole movie right out from under its stars takes a bit of skill, and I think he does that.
Well, I'll challenge at the end of the podcast this notion of tentpole movie. I won't get into neither here nor there, but I will say that clearly the ponytail, which is on the surface, but yeah, when I see him in this movie, I'm thinking Seagal, no doubt about it. There's clearly some comparisons there, but I'll get into my more thoughts. You ready to break down the plot of this wonderful movie, Andrew?
Yeah, it should take about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, indulge me because we open up with, we got a montage. Come on, everybody.
We got a montage. We're going to go back in time. We're going to do a montage tonight.
Miyagi and Daniel. So, we again get that opening montage. And like Andy said, from his comments on the last podcast, clearly the montage is articulating the themes here in the movie, because they're touching up, and maybe I'm wrong, I'll throw it to Andrew in a second, but clearly you're talking about the themes of no mercy on the montage and beating your opponents senseless and showing no mercy. And again, I guess the other thing that's interesting to me is, Andrew, is you get a note for note recap of the first movie with no mention or even a visual acknowledgement of Karate Kid Part 2. So it was very strange. I'll throw it to you. Thoughts on the opening montage of Karate Kid Part 3?
Well, like I said, and you just repeated, it's only concentrating on what we need to know for this coming movie. So this movie is very heavily dependent on the first one with nothing to do with the second one. So that answers your question as to why you're shaking your head.
I don't like it.
Are you disagreeing?
I don't like it. I don't like, one of the things I will say about Cobra Kai is it acknowledges a lot in the Karate Kid movies, warts and all. And for me, for a franchise to work, again, I'm speaking as a 50-year-old dude here, watching them. I mean, you just had Karate Kid 2, not nary a mention of Karate Kid 2. It doesn't make any sense to me.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but what I'm saying,
am I being too nitpicky?
I don't know. No, you're not. And I agree with it, because really, and that's part of the problem that I have with it, because with this movie is, even though this is another movie that I enjoy watching, even though I know it's not good. Back to the montage for a second. They're touching on the points, like you said, that we're going to have to know. So they give us a little brief thing showing us how Miyagi and Daniel met. Then they go right into the dojo, because this, if the first movie is Daniel's story, the second movie is Miyagi's story, in my opinion, this movie is Kreese's story. Even though he's not in it that much, it's still about, it still centers around, the whole thing centers around Kreese's revenge on Daniel. That's the catalyst for the whole movie. So they're only going to show us, things that connect to that. You know,
how can it be a movie? I don't disagree with you, but how could it be a movie about a character that's really not in the movie very much?
Well, number one, that's very easy because it's been done before. A great example is a movie that I just watched recently. You're going to hate me again.
I probably am. Go ahead.
I watched the three Mighty Ducks movies were on. And the third Mighty Ducks movie, the third Mighty Ducks.
Give me something. I mean, come on.
I'm giving it to you. I'm telling you.
Mighty Ducks.
I'm telling you.
Legitimate. Are you going to tell me that perhaps Rocky Five is Mickey's movie because Rocky has flashbacks of Mickey?
No.
To me, if I could just
say. I'm telling you. I'm telling.
But can I say here?
Yeah.
This movie to me is really about Daniel and Miyagi's relationship, because now you're getting a more fleshed out, you've got conflict, they've got things to overcome. I'm not disagreeing about your points with Kreese, because I do agree with that, but I don't know, to me it's hard for me to buy into a movie about a guy who's just he's really a limited character in this movie.
Yeah, but like I said, the entire plot of the movie hinges on his desire for revenge for somebody else losing the tournament to Daniel. So without him, there's no, it's a completely different movie, for better or worse. But the reason I say Mighty Ducks, is because the third Mighty Ducks movie is actually, if you look at it, it's really about the relationship between Emilio Estevez and then the kid that he mentors. Even though Emilio Estevez is hardly in the movie, it's written in such a way where he is always present. But
I'm sorry, is this a
all right, okay.
I can't believe he's trying to articulate.
No, because
his
it's the same. It's the
Ducks
same.
Three.
It's the same principle. But you know, the getting back to. You know,
yes, please. Let's get back to the original point.
I don't even know either.
Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you about the montage.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Why couldn't they have just broke down real quick Karate Kid 2, respect the viewer, let's see what's happened to these characters prior, and then let's just go into 3. Why do we have
I
to
agree. I agree. But like so many movies do, they choose to write it off with a piece of dialogue, and I can name them right now. They do the Kumiko thing by saying, oh, she got a job with a dance troupe, so she didn't come. Why is Miyagi broke when he's got all these beautiful houses and beautiful cars?
I got notes. Come on.
Hold on. You asked, and I got to answer. They fixed that with a line of dialogue. They spent all his savings rebuilding the house in Okinawa. With one line of dialogue, they take care of that. And, you know, it's lazy. It's lazy writing. I agree with you. That instead of, you know, they should show us. But all they do is, coincidentally, Kreese gets out of the car, goes into the airport, and magically, at the same exact time, even though we know that you go into the airport on the upper level and out of the airport on the lower level, they're coming in they're leaving the same time that Kreese is,
yeah, good.
You know.
Thank you. Thank you for stealing my thunder. I have it in my notes. I actually watched on Quibi or whatever, kudos, whatever.
Quibi? What's that?
Voodoo. Well, let's get back to it, Andy. In September 1985, Kreese, who is now broke and destitute, And may I say, looking a little bit John Rambo-ish here.
Yes.
I mean, he's got the tasseled hair. He's got the green Vietnam veteran jacket.
Well, he did. Well, Martin Cove did just come back from fighting a mission with Rambo. He was in Rambo First Blood Part 2.
Thank you. After the loss of his students, visits his Vietnam War comrade, Terry Silver, a wealthy businessman who founded Cobra Kai and now owns a toxic waste disposal business. Terry Silver is a very, very wealthy businessman. As the butler servant comes in with the Mr. Silver to say, Mr. Silver, let's sign the plutonium deal. Just so we can know that he's super wealthy, you know. And he's an evil businessman, you know. The butler's going to just walk in like that's typical. Sign the plutonium deal right here. After he's in a karate sparring session. Silver vows to personally help Kreese get revenge on Daniel and Mr. Miyagi and reestablish Cobra Kai, sending Kreese on vacation to Tahiti to make sure he rests and recuperates. Because, Gru, that's what friends do. When friends are stressed out, we just go into our bank accounts and say,
"Yes,
you know,
here, take $50,000.
Andy once called me upset, and I went, Andy, quickly, I'm going to wire you $7,000. Please take yourself to the Bahamas and, I don't know. They send long lost friends to Tahiti. Here's what I will say about this. I wrote in my notes. And I don't know if this vibes with you, but Silver physically looks younger than Kreese. I don't know. I feel like it was hard for me even the vibe that they fought in Vietnam together. Like, they look age-wise. And again, maybe I'm nitpicking. Am I being a douche here?
No,
please let me
know.
But
I feel like
Kreese looks older. And it's not to say that people of different ages don't fight in a war together. But
not only is Terry Silver not only is Thomas Ian Griffith younger than Kreese, Thomas Ian Griffith is younger than Ralph Macchio. I think they're the same
Macchio
age.
Was
I believe
27. Macchio
yes,
was
and
27.
I believe Terry Silver was also 27, but like 5 or 6 months younger than Macchio. So what I was going to say is he looks a little young to have fought in Vietnam. They definitely took liberties with that one. Cause he's definitely a kid compared
to. He's like, hey, I just fought in Vietnam! Come on, everybody! Let's go roller skating!
You and I are 25 years older than Thomas Ian Griffith is in that movie.
Well, as Andy mentioned, and I have in my notes, and again, I watched this and I went, oh my God, what a cheap ploy. Of course, as Kreese goes into the airport, magically, who's coming back home to Southern California? Daniel and Mr. Miyagi. And again, Gru talked about the whole airport level, but it's lazy. And I guess, I'm going to jump to the end a little bit because I'm listening to your comments. I understand your point about enjoying a movie, but it's hard for me to buy in like that. I really enjoy the whole film viewing process when I could pick apart a movie so easily.
But that's the thing.
One of the things I always tell Andy is don't be on the fence, and he's not on the fence here. He's saying he enjoys the movie, but.
It's fun to pick them
maybe,
apart.
Maybe I liked watching the movie, enjoying a separate. I don't know.
Like, would we pick?
There's a lot to pick apart here. There's a lot to be critical.
Yes, but it's fun to pick apart a movie. Like, we don't do podcasts about movies that we hate or artists that we hate. We do it. We do them about things that interest us. So, at the absolute minimum, this movie interests us enough. That we want to pick it apart. Otherwise, it'd be completely boring. But I do want to say that, you know, it does indicate a little bit of a passage of time. It sounds like because right before they go to Okinawa in 2, they had just had the prom. So that means they're going into summer and he's supposed to start college right here. So I'm guessing they spent about 2 months in Okinawa around then. And if you look at Daniel, he must in that couple months.
He must have went
nuts at the sushi bar every night because he's still a good looking dude, but you know he's definitely got the 30-year itch coming headed his way.
Well, I think a discernible eye, when you look at him, it doesn't look like it's just 2 months. It looks like it's 2 to 4. I mean, he looks older. He looks broader. He looks a little chunkier, but I don't really give a crap about that. But he doesn't look like it's just
the next
4 or 6 months
right.
down a timeline.
Right. Exactly. You know, so yeah. Speaking of lazy, they could have waited and have him gotten to better shape.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about lazy. Upon returning to L.A. from Okinawa, Daniel and Miyagi discover that all of a sudden their South Seas apartment complex is now being demolished.
Yes, so Daniel is now homeless.
Before we get to Daniel's mother, I mean, aren't there notices?
No, it does not work that way. It doesn't work that way.
All right, let's move on. Let's move on. Of course, they bring the
lazy
neighbor back
why.
Who's like, yeah, you're out of a job, Miyagi, the old woman from the pool.
The dog lady.
So, now, Andy, let's get into some more what I think is ridiculousness. We'll hear Andy's thoughts in a second. They also learned that Daniel's mother, Lucille, is currently in New Jersey taking care of Daniel's ill Uncle Louie. And we know that Uncle Louie is sick. How do we know that, Gru? It's evidenced by he's in the bed in the background with persistent hacking coughing.
Yeah.
And then we learn in their dialogue, as Andrew has also mentioned, that Kyuki, whatever her name is, Kyoto, Kayaki.
Oh, my God. We're going to have to put this disclaimer on this one.
It's lazy. She's now not going to visit Daniel. By the way, there was never a mention that she was coming to the States, but now she's not going to visit Daniel in the good old USA because she's got a job with a dance company in Tokyo. As she mentioned in Karate Kid 2, I'm getting fired up, how she wanted the dream to be a dancer, but there was no avenue to even learn. There was no schools. Gru, who wrote this shit? I mean, this is terrible.
You're absolutely right.
Drink of water,
what about Yukie? She said at the end of the movie that she was coming with Miyagi. She's like, take me with you as he's packing. So why isn't she there? Lazy.
Well,
she would have just gotten away.
I didn't even mention that.
Everybody, that's the thing. Everybody kind of gets in the way because they have no way to write around them. And like, if you notice when Lucille is talking on the phone and you've got Uncle Louie hacking up a lot in the background, it's so obvious that they're not in the same room. It's so obvious, like it's so badly budgeted where either the actress was so busy with whatever she was doing that she had to like be hologrammed in or something or use the blue screen. Yeah. If you look at it again, you can tell very clearly it was definitely a like green screen or blue screen, whatever.
Ooh. That's actually interesting. I'm going to go back and take a look at it. I just felt like forgetting that. It's just lazy, like, he's just like, oh, we know the uncle is sick. How? Because he's in a bed hacking, you know. It just seemed very forced. And I guess the thing with, the girlfriend with Daniel, it doesn't even make sense. She openly admits in the second movie, I want to be a dancer. There's no schools around here. And Daniel says, go for your dreams. Now all of a sudden she does one dance. And now she's found a job at a dance company. It's just really
lazy.
It's super late, but super wacky. It just doesn't even make sense. I don't know. It's just,
yeah,
I don't
it's,
know.
It's, well, it makes sense. It just makes stupid sense. It's, you know, it's,
well,
it's lazy writing. They needed to get her out of the way.
Let's move on, Andy. Miyagi invites Daniel to stay at his home. And Daniel uses his college funds, because that's what people do, to help finance Miyagi's dream of opening a bonsai shop. Like, doesn't call his mom and say, Mom, by the way, you know, the $20,000 or whatever you slaved for, I'm just going to put it into a bonsai shop for Mr. Miyagi.
Yeah.
As thanks, Miyagi makes him a partner in the business. Okay. They do a man-on-man kata, which is, I don't know if it's homoerotic or whatnot, but it's a pretty effective scene.
If it is, we'll put a disclaimer on the beginning of this.
Yes, they did. Now we get to some plot. Miyagi politely refuses to train Daniel for the next All Valley Karate Tournament.
Wait, can I ask a question here? Can I ask a question here? And I'm sure this has been asked, but Daniel is 17 years old, correct?
Well, he looks 30, but yes, he's 17.
He's supposed to be 17.
Let's say he's 17 or 18. Oh, go ahead.
Well, he couldn't be 18 because the tournament is under 18.
Okay, fair enough.
So, how many 17-year-olds you know who are supposed to be starting in college?
I did start at 17, but I was born late. But it's under the it could be feasible.
It could be feasible. All right. It seems convenient, but all right. I'll go with that.
Here's my question to you: if you were Daniel, would you want to fight again in the All Valley tournament?
Hell yeah, I'd want to defend my title.
Absolutely. Knowing what I know about Daniel, or perhaps my own self, I'd be like, look, I escaped winning by the hair of my chinny chin chin, and I'm just going to bask in the glow of one time I was champion of the world. I'll get girls, I'll blah, 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 blah. But
he doesn't go out and get girls. All he does is hang out with this old guy.
Yeah,
he
doesn't do anything. He's certainly a polite cat. That's for sure.
I feel like I would want to defend the title. And he actually does say at some point, he's like, even before the whole bad guy thing starts, he's like, I'm proud of the title. I want to defend it. And I can understand that. I can go.
Fair point. We have the scene where Daniel goes across the street to the pottery store. He meets Jessica Andrews. They kind of give you a little brief hint of romance, and then, of course, she smacks it down by saying she has a boyfriend back home in, of course, the great city, and it is a great city of Columbus, Ohio. But she and Daniel agree to remain friends because that's what most teen boys do. They agree to remain friends.
They just want to be friends.
You mean hormones aren't just completely ravaging their body and they don't just want to blah, 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 blah.
Have a nice, beautiful, platonic, statutory relationship.
Well, I will say this. I mean, I thought the casting beyond her age, again, she's 17, but, you know, the Jessica Andrews, pretty girl. I think, you know, they're able to sort of embody this very wholesome, pretty teen female lead, so to speak. I hope I'm not putting my foot in my mouth.
But number one, she's not in it nearly enough. And number two, she has nothing to do with any part of the plot. She's virtually meaningless.
It's a romance with no romance. That's what I wrote in my notes. I mean,
it's just a romance with no romance. It's this hot girl becomes the wacky sidekick, except she's not a sidekick and she's not wacky. So she's just across the street and she makes pots and she's leaving and she has a boyfriend somewhere else. I mean, you know, they're literally piling on the reasons for her not to be in this movie. And yet,
your take on it, and you could just see Dice Clay going, she makes pots. She's your friend. What is wrong with you?
Get down on your knees.
Monica Wabanski. All right. Terry Silver hires Mike Barnes.
How do you hire somebody to win a kiddie tournament? Because that's what it is.
Talk about creepy too. Like, hey kid, come over here. I'm going to hire you. he's a karate prospect named Karate's Bad Boy.
Well, here's my question though. Like you say, he hires him. And I've seen this movie dozens of times, maybe more, and I never asked myself this question until the last time I watched it, which was a couple days ago. Is Mike Barnes under 18, or are they fixing the tournament? Because you know Terry Silver has the resources to, you know, get the guy a fake ID or create some kind of – are they throwing this thing?
I think that's a fair question. They don't really allude to it from what I remember. Now, I do remember that Mike Barnes is a shrewd negotiator. And
at 17 years old, though, that's the thing.
Yeah, at 17, for him to now also work in a 50% ownership in Cobra Kai, which is franchised, that's a pretty good effing deal. So, first of all, Mike Barnes looks – same thing with LaRusso. They look over 18. I mean, yes. Clearly – They're not old, but they're certainly not teenagers anymore.
Right.
So, you know, I think that's a good question. The only thing that the film alludes to is the fact that Mike Barnes is no dummy and he's going to negotiate with Terry Silver.
Right. And it just, you know, the only reason I brought that up is because, number one, you're right. Look, they had to cast Macchio because it's his role, but they needed to cast somebody who's kind of physically imposing. So it's obviously someone who's going to look older. So I wonder, you know, maybe they are like messing with things. I don't know. Could be. That would make me feel a little bit better about it.
Yeah, I hate to admit this, but when I was at Camp Wayne and I was coaching under 14 baseball, I made a deal with a local Scranton boy, Kelly Leak. I paid him in beer
canteen
and cigarettes.
Beer.
Yeah, the kid had a rifle arm in the right field, and I just couldn't. I mean, the thing is, like, is somebody so invested in like a teen karate tournament that they're, I mean, itself on the surface.
Well, I understand what they're trying to do because, and it's actually alluded to later on in Cobra Kai, but, they're trying to get the business going again. They insinuate that when Cobra Kai lost, you know, they lost all their students because all those guys were Cobra Kai, basically.
And they say it in the movie.
Right.
They say it.
Yeah, so one could buy that. One could buy that the business went under after they got humiliated at the tournament.
I agree.
And he did that stupid shit outside with the trophy and everything. So if their aim is to get their students back, open up the dojos again. And as he's dropping them off at the airport, I think the revenge on Daniel is kind of like set up as a bonus, you know, this is the money shot here. We're going to get you. You're going to be back. Your business is going to thrive. But you know what? I'm also going to make this kid hurt for what they did to you. Like, so the main plot of the movie doesn't even matter. It's like they're doing it just as like a little bonus. Although I think it does, I think him, for Cobra Kai to
it
win,
it doesn't
the,
matter.
For Cobra Kai to win the title back, they need to beat the, you know, if you want to be the man, you got to beat the man.
So what they're doing. Oh my God. Get to your point. Let's move on. Come on. Let's go.
That is my point. What they're doing kind of makes sense. It's just, they do it in such a silly way.
Well, and then I like the negotiating scene because Silver is in a tub.
Yeah.
And he's talking about dumping silver chloride, whatever, disgusting, you know, half naked with the secretary taking notes. Like, you know, no sexual harassment. You
yeah,
know,
not at all.
You know, the secretary is just
and
taking
I also
notes.
Like, I also like how he's like dictating a letter and he's dictating like a business letter and he's like, all right, Margaret, read it back to me. And she's like, and if you don't do it, I'll sue your collective asses and screw you and fuck you. And he's like, best to Lori and the kids, Terry. Like, you know, like, I always find that funny. And then she tells him he's being indicted about something or like he's got to go to court. And he's like, who's the DA on the case? He's like, Mr. Forkvisor. And he's like, oh, all right, have Willie over for dinner next Saturday. Like, he obviously owns the entire world.
Yeah.
You know?
It just, I just wrote in my notes, was just plain silly. Silver sneaks into Miyagi's house to gain information and overhears Daniel telling Miyagi that he will not defend his title at the tournament. Yeah, you know, Terry Silver, who's like a kabillionaire, he's gonna like literally himself sneak into his house and hide in a dirty fireplace, no less. you know, Barnes, Mike Barnes and his henchmen, Snake and Dennis, harass Daniel in an attempt to force him to enter the tournament, but Daniel still refuses and Barnes departs in a rage. The next morning, as Daniel and Miyagi are practicing their kata, Silver interrupts their training and lies about John Kreese suffering a fatal heart attack after losing his students and begs forgiveness for Kreese's behavior. Barnes, Snake, and Dennis return to make Daniel sign up for the tournament. When Daniel again refuses, a fight ensues until Miyagi arrives and fends off the three men, a vaguely familiar-looking fight. After driving Jessica home, Daniel and Miyagi return to find their stock of bonsai trees missing and a tournament application hanging in place. Daniel reports the theft to the police. They do not take him seriously. So we got a little bit of a chunking of the plot. We got Mike Barnes. We got Silver hiding. We got Daniel being bullied to try to sign to fight. We got bonsai tree missing. Gru, thoughts up to this point?
Well, it's all exactly what it's supposed to be. It's mind-numbingly stupid, but it's kind of supposed to be because they just want you to check your brain at the door and just follow these people where
why
down whatever.
Why?
Because
why don't they respect the first Karate Kid movie, which is borderline genius? Why do they got to do this?
I do think that there's an element of laziness. They're like, literally we can do what we want, and it's not, and no one's going to, they're not here for some massive plot or whatever that, you know, and it's lazy. It's like we can just, it's kind of like the very next year. And yes, I'm going to go here. Okay. Oh. The very next year. Okay, John Avildsen makes Rocky V, where basically they said, we could just put Rocky back in the streets of Philadelphia and people will come. Well, no, you actually have to have a fucking script. And
well,
that's, and
I don't
that's
want to get
kinda,
into Rocky V.
No, but that's kind of what happened here.
I don't, I think it was, I give credit, I don't want to, you know my position. They tried, it failed, but they tried here. I mean, they took Rocky out of its element. We've discussed it already. Here, it's just I don't know. All right, let's move on. to replace the missing trees, listen to this one.
Oh,
Daniel and Jessica decide to dig up and sell a valuable bonsai tree that Miyagi bought from Okinawa and placed halfway down a cliff. By the way, I love this line. Daniel says, where's the tree? In between two ropes. And then I wrote, those aren't ropes. Oh! Which, by the way, I mean, Andy, they have to like, rappel down a side of a cliff. Two freaking LA teens. Oh, apparently she's an expert at rock climbing. She must be Monica Dominion. All of a sudden. Now she's running the ropes course. Okay, he drops the tree. Oh, he drops the tree. Here's my notes, by the way. He clearly cares more about the tree than his very cute female accomplices.
Well,
like, screw you, I gotta get the bonsai.
If she's not giving him anything, what would
true.
You, you know, what would you do?
True, yeah, I guess you're right. upon review, the call as stands, Daniel is correct. As they retrieve, the tree, Barnes and his henchmen magically appear.
Wait, listen to what you just said. Say that sentence again. We're talking about the Karate Kid.
As they retrieve the tree, Barnes and his henchmen magically appear like they know somehow.
What fucking movie are we talking about?
Okay, but wait a second. Was there some hint? Because they do a wide shot of them rappelling down the mountain or down this, I don't know if it's a mountain, but it's certainly a steep hill to get the bonsai tree. There is a wide shot that kind of looks like his binoculars. Am I reading into it? Is there some kind of tent or, I mean, did those guys have any knowledge? Cause on the surface, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
You're right. And I never noticed that binocular shot before.
I'm not saying it is a binocular shot, but there is a wide shot that looks like it could be people watching them two going down a hill.
Very possible. I don't think it matters. We just have to assume that those guys spent all day and night following these two guys. And they just these two people, and they just end up, every time they end up at the mountain, these guys are always there. Now, I don't know where the hell this mountain is, because they're supposed to live in the valley.
Right.
You know, which is nowhere near, if my memory of Los Angeles, geography serves, they would have to go all the way across into like Hollywood and all the way down towards Malibu. Like they, there's just so much.
Well, Andy, you don't go to Malibu to rehabilitate your bonsai trees? I mean, everyone's doing it.
Well, not since they put up those traffic patterns. Because, I mean, it's a whole day thing. Like, you know, it takes forever to get there, then forever to get back. You can't park. So I don't know what these, you know, like, but evidently these guys can just walk there. So good for them.
Well, Barnes and his henchmen, Snake and Dennis or whoever else,
Snake,
they fuck with their climbing ropes, and Daniel's got a sign for the tournament. And they do pull him back up as they promised, but of course Barnes breaks the tree. completely overacted. But what I will say about this is Ralph Macchio does a good job here of portraying Daniel's desperation. I did think he does an actual solid job of acting, because you've literally, when he breaks the tree, the other guys are overacting.
Yeah.
But Daniel's look, Macchio's look, and like the air kind of deflates out of his lungs. He knows that his mentor is going to be super upset. Maybe not at him, but super just completely damaged, yes, that his tree has been damaged or screwed with. And, you know, he goes, so Daniel returns back to the shop with the damaged bonsai, which Miyagi attempts to mend. Miyagi tells Daniel that he sold his truck to buy a new stock of trees and refuses to train him for the tournament. And, Daniel, then, later on, there's a joke about a front sweep that you could read from a mile away. I've said a lot. I'll pause. Some good acting here, some ridiculous stuff. Grew, what about the bonsai tree, the hiking, the scaling, and everything else?
Well, the only thing that matters is the bonsai tree. You can get rid of everything else and find a better way to, you know, because Daniel, number one, Daniel taking the bonsai tree out from where it was, like that in and of itself is a very stupid thing to do. So,
well, I mean,
like,
he should have asked Miyagi, right?
Of course, like, you know, he was doing it, like, from what he was saying to the girl, he was doing it, like, to surprise Miyagi. And, like, that's just, again, it's lazy writing. It's how do we get them into trouble? Let's write them into trouble. You know? And they could have done it countless other ways. But,
yeah,
again, they get lazy. I mean, it's not the first time.
You have, I mean, a little bit of an interesting point where Silver befriends Daniel and he's going to train him in air quotes. Of course, I did notice that ridiculous joke about sweeping where he tells Daniel,
right,
shows Daniel, like on the street how to do a front sweep, and he runs to Miyagi all excited. Show me how to do a front sweep. And Miyagi, of course, brings a broom and, ha ha ha, hilarity, and chuckles ensue. So Silver trains Daniel Gru. They go to the Cobra Kai dojo, and right, it's a very much more brutal, much more violent, and you know, offensive techniques of karate. And I'm certainly not an expert in karate. Silver derides Miyagi's form of karate, makes fun of the katas, and pressures Daniel to destroy a wooden practice dummy, which injures Daniel in the process. And again, throughout the training, Daniel's frustration alienates himself from Miyagi. I'll give you a couple of thoughts. I thought that the scenes with training with Daniel, excuse me, training with Silver were pretty effective, though. I thought it makes the Daniel character look like a complete wimp. Like he couldn't leg kick, you know, do like a front sweep. Like he was like, ow. What I do say was very effective, when I do agree, the training scenes with Terry Silver, Thomas Ian Griffith are effective. Macchio stands out here because he says to himself, what am I doing? He knows what he's doing is wrong. He knows what he's doing is not good for him mentally, athletically, socially. And I could relate to that because so many times I've made choices and I know it's a bad choice, but I'm doing it anyway. Again, I felt like Macchio does a good job here portraying desperation. His back is up against the wall. He wants to compete. This guy Silver is going to help him, but he knows it's the wrong thing to do. Gru, the floor is yours.
Well, this leads me to something that bothered me when I watched it. And I realized that throughout the movie, from beginning to end, I did not like Daniel. He was unlikable in this movie. He just, even, you're right that the performance is good in some places where he does sort of project that desperation.
Oh, thank you that I'm right in some fashion. Thank you. I'm really shocked that you say that. I'm really shocked because I thought actually you're more all in on this franchise than me, and it would be harder for you to admit and for you to say that the tentpole character,
yeah,
the guy, yeah, is not likable. That's akin to you saying I didn't like Rocky in this movie. I'm sorry. That's really hard for me to accept.
Well,
I could accept that there's certain moments where he's not likable, but to say you didn't like him throughout this movie, I'll give you a credit for not being on the fence. But that's tough for me to hear.
I understand, and it was tough for me to feel when I was watching it, because he is such an endearing character, and he's an endearing actor. And as we did on our Revelation show, you know that Ralph Macchio is my guy, you know, my hometown boy. But but he's just, you know, his attitude and his sometimes goody two shoes. He's like nowhere in between. He's either like super goody two shoes or he's, you know, doing really, really dumb things. And there's something about his attitude and the way he does things that is just not likable. And you that doesn't mean you're rooting against him. You're never rooting against him. It's not like the performance is bad. It's badly written. The character is not well written in this movie. That's the problem. You can't take a horrible script and make it great with a great performance. You can take a mediocre script and make it great, but not a script that's going to look to cut every single corner that they can. And this one does, and they do with him. They don't. Well, listen, how much more likable would Daniel be in this movie if you showed us a scene with him and Allie, or you showed us a scene with him and his mother, instead of manufacturing them, if there was some emotional stake here? But there is none. It's just about a fucking tournament. Well, you know, when he fought Johnny in the tournament, that mattered. This doesn't.
If I may interject, yeah, a lot of good points, and I credit Andy for a strong take. That's a good strong take. I like that. He's not playing the middle. First of all, Daniel walks out, and Miyagi says, "Heart empty without you." And I'm like, are these guys dating now? What's going on here? But
then Miyagi starts crying. It's like
differ with Andy is I believe this movie is about Miyagi and Daniel's relationship, and so. The manufactured drama, and it's not done well, and it's sort of a gimmicky kind of deal, but, you know, it's like he's lost his way, and he's got to find his way back to Miyagi. Is it done? Are corners cut? Absolutely. If anything, I'm a little more critical, I think, than Andy. As a critical viewer, I mean, I could say I checked out within the first 6 minutes. Oh, you know, she's now a dancer. They just cut out kids. There's a lot there. There's a lot of cutting out corners. Yeah. If there are some good points to the movie, I thought actually I really bought into Macchio's performance here because he is playing a teen, and teens can be immature. And teens make bad decisions. And, you know, he does get redeemed at the end. So I actually bought into that a little bit more perhaps than Andy. But let me move on because there's some other fun things to pick on.
Okay.
So Daniel takes Jessica to a nightclub because that's where best friend guys and girls go. You know, sexy dancing, drinking. And by the way, little known fact, Kiss is the house band. so much like Paul
they
Stanley
might as well have been makeup, yeah,
you know, and of course Terry Silver bribes some random dude into provoking a fight with Daniel, who responds by punching the man and breaking his nose. Shocked by his aggressive behavior, Daniel apologizes And, you know, as soon as, you know, they're all disgusted, somehow a minute later he makes amends with Jessica, knock on door, hey, can I talk to you? And, and Miyagi. Now, what I will say is, I've never seen a guy go so far for a girl who's not your girlfriend. Like, yeah. He's actually runs back to her house and he's pleading with her, you know. I mean, you know, I'll get criticism. I mean, he's not getting anything in the deal.
And somebody he met, 2 days earlier?
Yeah, like, I don't know. Like, if it's his girlfriend and he's emotionally and, dare I say, romantically invested, I get it. But for a girl and they're just friends, I'd be like, I'll call her tomorrow and I'll apologize. Miyagi, I understand. Miyagi's is his dad, is his mentor. But I thought, again, Macho does a good job of being contrite. And so, Gru, you want to tear apart the nightclub scene? We get a little bit of an aggressive Danny LaRusso here.
Yeah, well, look, this is like the beginning of the third act. This is where, you know, it's all going to come crashing down. So they need a set piece. So there's, there's Terry, like, literally telegraphing every single move. All right, here's what I'm going to do tonight. What I'm going to do tonight. I'm going to pay some dude to come on to his girlfriend who's not his girlfriend. Then yeah. Daniel is, I know it because I know him so well over the last 3 days. He's going to punch the guy in the face. Then he's going to realize that he's all screwed up in the head. He's going to go back home to Mr. Miyagi. He's going to make up with him. Then he's going to come back to Cobra Kai and tell me that he's not going to defend. And that's when we're going to reveal our whole big secret. It's like one big long Dallas episode. And we say, no, JR, it wasn't me behind this deal. It was your old enemy, Jeremy Wendell from Westar. And he walks into the door. Oh my God, Jeremy, what are you doing here? It's like, that's what this was all like. And that's kind of why I don't hate it. Because it's so bad that I love it. It's so much fun to see the ridiculousness, but also, like you said, the actors sell it. Like Thomas Ian Griffith and Macchio, they do a great job with the crap that they're given. And I'm sorry, Robert Mark Kamen, but I'm sure you would agree that this is not good stuff. But the work that the actors do is terrific, and it brings us into it, you know, especially when he cut, you know, look, the whole scene, the whole part is ridiculous. Actually, my favorite moment of this whole section is after Daniel broke the guy's nose, he's on the phone, trying to get the nurse to let him talk to the guy.
I know.
And then he hangs up the phone and he's upset and Miyagi's just standing there giving him a death stare. And he goes just like this. He's like, oi. And like, you know that this is going to be the moment where Miyagi, you could see that Miyagi is very upset with him. But, you know, then he sees Mr. Miyagi and he turns around and he unloads all this stuff. And then obviously brings him to the tree, which is growing. Look how strong root, just like you, Daniel-san. And everything's all better. Except now that they have to go and fight the tournament. But,
well, thank you, Gru. Well, why don't we just wrap up the podcast here?
We are running out of time, but.
You can get more stunning insight on nothingworthwhile.net. No. First of all, I think that was a good take. Daniel visits Silver to inform him again that he's not going to compete in the tournament. By the way, as the dojo door is open at night, which is oh so common in California, you know, just keep the storefront door open. Thanks, Andy. Yeah. Appreciate it. way to support your buddy on my commentary. I listen to every word and he's on like his phone doing, posting on Instagram.
I'm not.
Silver does reveal his true evil agenda to Daniel as Barnes enters the dojo. Daniel attempts to leave. Now John Kreese appears to intercept him, revealing that he's been alive all along.
Oh, boy.
After Barnes viciously attacks Daniel, Miyagi intervenes. Somehow he knew. You knew. And easily defeats Kreese, Silver, and Barnes. And I'm sorry, Gru. In some of the worst karate ever seen on film, when Miyagi squares off against Silver, it's really bad karate. I'll get your opinion in a second, but I'm just telling you my take on it. Miyagi finally agrees to train Daniel after learning of their plot. They replant the heel bonsai and begin training. So Daniel is indeed going to fight in the All Valley Tournament. We got twists and turns. Kreese is alive. Andrew, the floor is yours.
This is such a great scene because it's so bad and it's so much fun.
Yeah, Kreese comes out. He's like, oh, like it's boom. Like he's a like, horror boom, film. Boom.
Ah. To your point about the lousy karate, yeah, 100%. Of course
it's
it is.
Terrible.
Of course it is. But by this point, you're okay with it because it's Pat Morita.
Like, well, Andy, here's the thing. Thomas Ian Griffith is apparently a real martial artist. He's younger. He's lean. I'm not saying I won't buy into a Miyagi victory, but it's so slow. I mean, I don't know. And I know it was filmed many years ago, but it just didn't look good on film when I watched it. You know,
I'll agree with that, but you also have to, and this is going to sound trite, but you also have to remember that Miyagi's philosophy of karate, and when he's fighting, he always shows that it's all defense. All he's doing is just stepping out of the way and countering. So he never throws the first punch. He never goes on offense. He just literally reacts to everything Silver does. While Silver and Cobra Kai's whole mantra is to strike first and do all that. So that's kind of, that makes, like, you saying that it's just so unrealistic that Miyagi would be able to take this guy. You're absolutely right.
No. I said I'd buy into it. I just said it was poorly done.
Okay.
I would buy into Miyagi. It just looked, it didn't look good.
Yes.
Let me ask you a quick question.
Go ahead.
On the production side, how much time we got left? I got a lot of notes still.
We have 35 minutes left.
All right.
But wait, I do want to mention one thing.
Go ahead.
Miyagi does, or Pat Morita does a really good thing here where he whips him into the mirror breaks, the paint comes out on him, and then Miyagi literally bows. And I really actually like that. I like that he bows to him because he still respects the whole karate thing. The karate thing is much bigger than anything else. But then he does that little thing where he's making fun of him. He's like, wah. I like that. I laughed at that.
Well, clearly that's him breaking down. There's a lot of, you know, slope, chain. I mean, there's a lot of really racist.
Yeah.
There is a lot. I mean, there's a lot of comments like that really up the ante. And one of the things critically is, you know, the violence in this movie is a little heavier. The language in this movie is a little heavier.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps that might be due to kind of take a little bit of the edge off maybe the material. I don't know. But we'll get into that when we get to the critical pieces. Let's just wrap up this movie because we got a lot of stuff even to move on with. So we get to the final round because there's a new rule, Andrew, in the All Valley Karate Tournament. That the champion just makes his way to the final round of the tournament, which, look, I'll buy into that the champion gets a bye in the first round, but
not the whole tournament.
I mean, come on, Andy.
Lazy. It's all lazy.
Well, Silver, the president of Dynatox Industries, as they announced him in the beginning. I love that name, Dynatox.
Yeah.
And Kreese instruct Barnes to inflict serious damage on Daniel, keeping the score at a tie, and then to finally beat him in the sudden death round, which I don't get either. I mean, I don't want to belabor the point. If you're going to win, close it out. And, you know, I guess they're trying to what? These guys are so diabolical that they just want to inflict more pain. But here's where we get to it. When the initial round concludes, Daniel wants to quit. He tells Mr. Miyagi that he's afraid, he's scared, and he wants to quit. And Miyagi urges him to continue to not give in to the fear. What did you think about that?
I do like this part. I like when Miyagi yells at him. He really has never yelled at him before. So he's like, oi, 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 oi! Like that, like, and you know, the music's like, dong, like you've never seen Miyagi do this before. And he's like, I know the whole scene. He's like, you stay focused. Daniel-san, your best karate still inside. Now time let out. Okay, lose to opponent. Must not lose to fear. I like that whole thing.
I gotta tell you something, Gru. If you could pause, I'm inspired. I'm ready to do like 50 push-ups. Thank you.
I can do like three.
Now, would I be wrong just to say that that reminded me a little bit of Rocky III? I mean, I'm sorry.
Yeah, he says it. Okay. I'm afraid. Same
okay,
thing.
Thank you.
It's the same thing.
Okay. In the sudden death round, Daniel performs the kata. When Barnes lunges to him, Daniel flips him to the ground and strikes him to win the tournament. Silver leaves in disgust while the crowd throws Cobra Kai merch back at Kreese, which is great.
I love when he does the thing
great
with the elbow.
See, Kreese gets up on a chair.
He's like, all of a sudden, like, he's a pro wrestler. He's a heel wrestler.
He's
going to
fight everybody. And Daniel and Miyagi celebrate their victory with a hug. All right, well, we're going to wrap it up here in terms of the movie. Gru, what did you think of the ending with the kata?
I hated it.
And Daniel winning with that final strike.
I hated it. There's one thing I like about it. I like the kata thing because I like the thing that goes from movie to movie is he always ends up using something new that he's learned to win. In the first one, it's that crane. In the second one, it's the drum thing. And then in the third one, it's the kata. So I like that part of it. But the rest of it sucks, and I'll tell you why. Because literally, this guy is kicking the shit out of him for 3 minutes.
Yes.
I don't think Daniel gets one offensive move in. Keeps knocking him down, knocking him on his ass. Then Miyagi says is, "Don't lose to fear." And then he gets up, does one move, and then it's over. Yeah, lazy. Now, if he had been in the whole tournament, you're talking that would have worked. Because by then, he would have, you know, it just would have worked. But if you're just showing up for one match, you're fresh, he's not, and then he's just kicking the crap out of you, and then you just use one move, flip him over, and it's all, and that's it. It's not about anything. It becomes about the scheme rather than the result. Because you're not happy. You're not happy that Daniel won and became a man or came of age. No, he beat Terry Silver and John Kreese. That's what he did. So the whole thing becomes very artificial in the way that they resolved it. That's my take.
Couldn't said it any better myself. I think Gru's point, if they would have showed him competing against others or getting some offense in on Barnes, would have perhaps made him more realistic. I didn't like the kata, but I love the ending too. I mean, I felt when he gets it and when he finishes the kata and gets that strike in, you know, I jumped out of my seat, but I'm 50, so I can't really jump anymore. So I hopped out of my seat and I was happy. So, Gru, what was the critical response to The Karate Kid Part 3? On Rotten Tomatoes, the film holds
Let me guess. I'm going to say the approval rating for Karate Kid 3 is 27%.
Oh, what if I told you it was 15%?
Wow. I gave it too much credit.
Okay, Andrew,
I do think I know the box office, though.
Okay, well, let's play out the critical response. I just want to hear you. I just took a little snippet.
Okay.
Based on 33 reviews with an average rating of 3.93 out of 10, Gru, the website's critical consensus reads, "Inspiration is in short supply with this third Karate Kid film, which recycles the basic narrative from its predecessors, but does add some scenery-chewing performances and a surprising amount of violence." On Metacritic, you want to give a guess out of 100? What was the weighted score out of 100 on Metacritic?
I'll go a little lower. I'll go 20.
36 out of 100,
wow,
based on 12 critical reviews, indicating generally unfavorable reviews. Audience polled by CinemaScore on a grade from A to F. What do you think the audiences gave it?
I would say audiences probably gave it a B or a C plus.
Good, B minus on an A to F scale.
Right,
audiences seem to rank it a little bit higher. Roger Ebert, who praised the first two films,
One and a half.
He didn't recommend it. I don't have much there. Gene Siskel also did not recommend the film, although he did commend the performance of Thomas Ian Griffith, which he thought was nearly enough to save it. Criticism: often mentioned the rehashing of elements of the former two movies, including a tournament against Cobra Kai and a romance side story. Kevin Thomas of the LA Times stated, writer Robert Mark came and gave director Avildsen and his cast little to work with. Karen James of the New York Times was critical of the lack of character development for the film's protagonist, saying, he has aged about a year in movie time and hasn't become a day smarter, and nullified the film for having the rote sense of filmmakers trying to crank out yet again another moneymaker. This movie did not do well in the critical realm, grew at the 1989 Golden Raspberry Award. the Golden Raspberry Awards. Yeah. The entry received, Kid 3 received 5 nominations, but did not win any of them. Worst Picture, which went to Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. Worst Screenplay, which went to a Gru favorite, Harlem Nights.
What?
Worst Director, which went to William Shatner for Star Trek V. Worst Actor, which went to William Shatner for Star Trek V.
Star Trek V isn't that bad.
And Worst Supporting Actor, which went to Christopher Atkins for Listen to Me.
What?
No, I will not listen to you. Gru, in 2015, John G. Avildsen himself called the film a poor imitation of the first one and, quote, a horrible movie.
All right, I don't feel so bad now.
Would you like to hear one general dissenting opinion about the movie, A Bonsai Tree of Truth? I found an article, Gru, from the todayshow.com, which says,
like a positive?
Why the Karate Kid Part 3 is the best film in the trilogy.
Ooh, I would love to hear this.
Okay, I will give it to you. The much maligned final chapter in the trilogy has its merits. It's a little bit to read. Pause me if you want to make any comments. I'll try to summarize as we go along. Author says as they were binge watching the second season of Cobra Kai, one scene really caught my attention. Danny LaRusso stood in front of his karate students and opened up about a dark and painful time in his past, the time that he joined the Cobra Kai dojo. I learned to strike first, strike hard, show no mercy, and it turned me into an angry and violent kid, he recalled. It changed me. You never told me about any of this, his daughter Sam replied. It's not something I'm proud of, Sam, he replied. The author says that they were happy to see that the events of Karate Kid Part 3, the much maligned final chapter in the Machio Morita trilogy, was referenced in Cobra Kai.
Okay.
I'm sure many...
All right. I mean, I get what they're trying to say, but the problem is, they're right to an extent. It is cool what they do in Cobra Kai with this
Don't
whole thing.
Don't give me too much Cobra Kai stuff, but
no, I'm not. I'm not giving you any. I'm just saying it is cool what they did in referencing it. But at no point in Karate Kid 3 are you even thinking that Daniel is joining Cobra Kai. Never once did that thought cross my mind. This was a guy teaching him karate to be in a tournament. So I don't buy that argument because, number one, he never wears the Cobra Kai stuff, which all those students always do. He always wears the gi that Miyagi gave him. He always wears the headband, which is the Miyagi-Do headband. So he's not joining – he doesn't join Cobra Kai. But it does – you know, he does get a little violent, more violent than, you know, with the guy, you know, that he punches in the nose at the disco. So there is some credence to that argument, but you're never thinking Cobra Kai when he's, when, during that movie. So they didn't do it well enough. Now, if they did it well enough, where Daniel really is now a full-fledged Cobra Kai member, that would be cool. That would have made the movie work much better. Get rid of all that shit with Jessica, all that stuff, all that wasted time, and put some more of that in. Now you're talking. But a missed opportunity.
All right, well, let me go on to what the author says. There's a little bit, he has a few other points. He says most Karate Kid fans will think he's nuts for actually liking part three. And actually, he quotes Today Show host Willie Geist, who calls the first Karate Kid a classic, which I agree. And he said that I could dismiss your take that Karate Kid is the best Karate Kid movie as gratuitous clickbait contrarianism if it wasn't so darn dangerous. To distort history is to deprive young people and future generations of the fundamental fact that the original Karate Kid is the only Karate Kid movie. Macho and Billy Zabka, I will accept your apology. But let me move on. What makes part three so special? Terry Silver, the lead villain,
yes,
played to perfection by Thomas Ian Griffith. He's tall, he's athletic, he's rich, he has a ponytail, and he's out to make life miserable for Daniel as a favor to John Kreese. When I'm finished with that kid, he'll be begging me to be his teacher, he explains to Kreese on the phone while working up a sweat in a sauna. And you know what he's going to learn from me?
Pain.
Pain in every part of his body.
And fear in every part of his mind.
And here's the kicker.
He's going to thank me for it.
You can thank the film director, the late John G. Avildsen, for allowing Griffith the freedom to add his own personal touch to the role. On the phone, Griffith was quoted, I give John Avildsen so much credit for that. Whatever you bring to the table, he would watch in rehearsals. I would try something and I would go for it, even if it was something that might be ludicrous. When Kreese says, make his knuckles bleed, Terry Silver thinks that's the most hysterical thing he's heard. And we were like, what else can we use to bring it in? Griffith recalled, Griffith was able to apply his extensive Taekwondo experience to the part. Originally, his character wasn't scripted to perform martial arts. The physicality, I could let loose and have fun with it and incorporate my background into the character he shared. In one of the more notable scenes in the film, Silver, Kreese, and their martial art for hire Mike Barnes challenge Mr. Miyagi to a fight. After Daniel wises up to their plan and after his knuckles bleed, of course, Miyagi, being the good guy, handles the Cobra Kai trio with ease despite being outnumbered. He tosses Silver into a mirror, causing the glass to shatter, as Gru has referenced, and buckets of paint pull on his head. Silver is angry, but as far as he's concerned, the broken shards of glass and paint in his slick back hair are only temporary setbacks. You think that this is the end of it, old man? I'm going to open up Cobra Kai dojos all over the valley.
Hell,
I might even teach for free. And then he says, from now on, when people say karate around here, there will be Cobra Kai karate, John Kreese's karate. You won't even be a memory.
Wait, can I try this part? Can I try this part? Yes, he will. You won't. Thank you.
And I will
come say, on, come on. That was all right.
That was very good, Andrew. I apologize. I'm under the time gun, so I just want to get to it. Griffith is a fan of the series, recalling that after watching the first season of Cobra Kai, he thought the cast and crew did such a great job, the acting, the writing, direction, the tone of the whole thing. I was really so pleased with it. And then it goes on to say that he's working on the NBC fantasy drama Grimm, and he has co-written an episode of Dolly Parton's Heartstrings, an upcoming Netflix anthology series based on the country legend's music. He has left the door slightly ajar for him to revive Terry Silver. And, of course, I just fast-forwarded my notes. Okay. He goes on to say it would be fun to see the whole gang. Now for the most important question. Does Griffith rank The Karate Kid Part 3 as the best movie in the franchise? Despite his connection to the film, his response will undoubtedly please Willie Geist and many other fans. The first film, there was such an innocence and simplicity. I think that there was something so special in that, and I think that's why it reached so many people. It was such a great character piece, Griffith said. I agree, the first film was so special, but it was the third film because of Terry Silver, who will always be a memory to me. So you do have one article online, Gru, putting Karate Kid Part 3 out there as the best. I'll throw it to you. We'll get to how much Kid 3, but this seems like a good spot to pause and get your take on Kid 3, wrapping it up, and to where you place Kid 3 in the franchise pantheon.
I place Karate Kid Part 3 as the... Are we including all five movies? Meaning next Karate Kid and the Jaden Smith version?
I'll leave it up to you. I mean, I think this is... You certainly have the... This is the end of the Macchio Morita.
All right,
of the
Macchio Morita ones, this is definitely the weakest. It goes 1, 2, 3 for me. It's simple. It's the weakest because of the writing, but there is good stuff in here. Griffith is terrific. I do like bringing Kreese is always a good villain, and you know, Miyagi's always, I mean, there's really good stuff. There's really bad stuff. It all adds up to not a good movie, but still enjoyable to watch. Like, it's a movie that if it's on, I'll watch it. It's just because it's something that I'm so familiar with. And I do enjoy it enough. You know, you can enjoy something that's not good. But you have a fondness for it for whatever reason. So, I can watch this in the same way I could watch a Rocky V. You know, I know it's not good, but there's stuff that I enjoy about it, that will always be there. And in this one, it's all, it's definitely Thomas Ian Griffith's performance. Without it, the movie is not worth a watch, in my opinion.
I agree with your takes. I'll just say this. While there's enjoyable elements to this film, I just didn't enjoy it as much.
That's fair.
Okay. You said you wanted to take a stab, Gru. You want to take a stab on how much money Karate Kid 3 grossed in the United States?
Yes.
Do you want to go with the budget? Do you know the budget? And you want to get a stab at the budget?
I would say the budget was probably somewhere in the $15 to $17 million range.
All right, hold on. Let me answer that.
Okay.
Gru knows his stuff. It's close, $12.5 million.
Okay, and I remember it not being the success that they thought it was going to be. And I'm going to say it made maybe $28, $29 million.
Interesting. Made close to $40 million, $38.9 million. So, Gru, let me ask you a question before we wrap it up. $12.5 million versus $38.9 million, made its money. How would a film studio look at that kind of money? Would they call that a success?
Back then, yes. Yeah, because it's not. You're not just talking about – that's just domestically. Karate Kid, I think, by that point was a worldwide franchise, so they probably made a lot of money overseas. They had merchandising stuff. You know, there's still Karate Kid toys. They had an animated $40 million against a 12 – they probably thought and hoped it would do more, but I don't think that they were – crying in their Rolls Royces over $40 million or $38 million against the $12 million.
I think they
were hoping that they would make enough money that they would be able to do more movies.
It's funny you mentioned about merchandise. I have still in the kitchen my Miss Miyagi juicer.
I have my chopsticks.
Yeah, my Mr. Miyagi. Look at him! You're so edgy.
My fly catching chopsticks. I think they were hoping for more, but, I think they were okay with what they got.
Well, I will take Andrew's comments and let me just pump up our next show next week. If we are all here healthy, ready to rock and roll, we're calling it, guys and girls, The Karate Kid, The Best of the Rest. We will discuss and break down the next Karate Kid and the 2010 reboot with Jaden Smith and Jackie Chan. Andrew, set the stage for our listeners. Any thoughts on Karate Kid, The Best of the Rest?
Well, I just know that I'm going to have
to... Be positive.
I'm going to have to sit and watch those movies again.
Okay.
Look, I've seen them both. I've only seen them each once, and that's what differs them from... Or that's one of the things that differs from all the other ones. All the other ones I've seen countless times.
Okay.
So I'm actually looking forward to watching the reboot again, even though I know I'm not going to like it as a movie, because I didn't when I saw it, because and we'll get into that. I'm expecting the next Karate Kid to watch that. I'm expecting that will be a painful watch, but I'll be able to do it. Because watching Miyagi is always the spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. You know.
Funny you mention that, because I'm actually looking forward to seeing both films again too. And I'm looking at it now at older with a little bit more of a critical eye. I'll probably be unfortunately disappointed, but I'll be looking for those little sparkles, those little hidden gems that maybe it, you know, as Andy talks about, endear me to a not so good movie, but I'll stick to, if I enjoy it, I certainly won't enjoy it as much. I don't want to say too much, but I am looking forward to sitting down and viewing the films and getting some notes and seeing what those two films offer me as a viewer.
Yeah. And I next Karate Kid's a little frustrating to watch because I don't know how old she is in it, but Hilary Swank has a sick body in that movie. And you just don't get to see it, which is really frustrating.
Yeah, listen.
But thank God for that. Thank God for that pause button.
Yeah, you can be
quack.
ID this.
Quack.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
All right. Well, look, we've almost broken. It's the longest. We've actually said Guinness just called me. We're the longest podcast in the history of podcasts for Karate Kid 3.
For Karate Kid 3, definitely. There's never been more discussion about this movie than we just did. So we definitely have a record there.
Well, Andy, I actually really enjoyed this one. I enjoyed talking about this movie. It's right up our alley.
Yes.
And you want to take us out of here?
Yes. Thank you all for tuning in, for hanging in there with us through these Karate Kids 1, 2, and 3. As you know, next week we'll be doing the best of the rest. And beyond that, we will be jumping into the universe of Cobra Kai. I don't know if we're going to be doing two separate shows for each season or one show for both. Either way, I cannot wait for that one because if you know me, you know I'm a huge Cobra Kai mark. But until then, again, we'd like to thank you here for joining us on Nothing Worthwhile. We will be back next week for you, with you, and because of you. But until then, folks, I want to say from us to you, 1, 2, 3.
Quack, quack. Dynatox.